Welcome to a new installment of Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me to my very left in the smoky side of the world is Jason.
Hello, everyone.
And we're going to be talking today about Carmine Orichio, or as we call him, John Saxon. He passed away in July, but this is the first time that you and I have sat down to talk in some time.
Have we not? We not done this since July? Is that true? Or did we? Did it
we,
happen?
We didn't do one in August, and that was weird because we were so super productive. Yeah, life gets busy, and
the world's about to end. Yeah,
I launched a magazine.
There's a lot of drinking to do because the world's about to end, so that might have interfered.
I think I should probably quit drinking at the world's end.
But we did want to do it. I actually watched, boy, if that was July, wow. I actually went over to, I think I texted you this, that I went over to a friend's house that night for backyard, drive-in sort of movie thing. It was me and him and his girlfriend in the backyard. And we watched Enter the Dragon that night in honor of John Saxon. So that was kind of our fun little tribute to
That's wonderful. Enter the Dragon, of course, is absolutely one of my favorite Saxon films. And probably a lot of where people know him from. But the guy, he's just a journeyman.
What a career. I mean, he
200
really...
200 projects.
Well, and he also came out of, if I'm... I could be wrong about this, but I remember reading about him once where he came out of sort of the, Robert Wagner... mid late 50s teen yeah. kind of heartthrob thing, and was in beach blankety kind of high school romance things, and then bopped around and worked with loads of people. I mean, we'll get to like how I first saw him and knew who he was, and then
something I wanted to say is I knew who he was as a kid, and that's very rare when you're a child to know who an actor is, especially one that like didn't really have, he wasn't Captain Kirk. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
he was just in everything. The guy really never got a series. And, it's an interesting thing, but he kind of goes into that whole, like, there were a lot of jobbing actors in the '70s who got a ton of work, but never had a home, and you knew who they were. And that Fantasy Island is riddled with them. And John Saxon's, of course, been on Fantasy Island a couple of times, so can always bring it back there.
What's interesting about him, I think, this is just my two cents about his vibe, his look, his delivery with stuff. I think maybe part of the problem was he was very, very good at what he did. He made it look easy, but you never saw him in something. What, as bad as some stuff was or whatever it was, he never really chewed the scenery. He wasn't Shatner. He wasn't big enough and broad enough to be, a Shatner, so he maybe it was hard and he wasn't quite like a Robert Wagner that was very, arch an eyebrow and kind of smooth talking and, quip, little quips and things like that. He also kind of had a look that I think started heartthrobby, but morphed into, he's kind of a badass. Like he would actually be the good, he'd be the good bad guy. Cause he looks,
you said he didn't chew the scenery, but we've both seen Battle Beyond the Stars.
Well, he probably, maybe he was like, I got to get out of here. I'm going to chew my way out of this thing. Maybe the-
Oh, no, I think we're all better for Sador. I think Sador is as large as he should be. But what I meant was, I know what you're saying. And that's the another thing about him is he vacillated. You could see him on, let's say, Starsky and Hutch 1 week, and he's a vampire. He plays a vampire in Starsky and Hutch. And then the next week, he's a good guy in the, you know, the Gene Roddenberry pilot. Like, he could go from hero to bad guy.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
No problem. And believable in both. And just, like, if you had a show in the 1970s, it was like, okay, so you got the pilot picked up and you got a 13-episode deal. Which one do you want John Saxon in? Like, it honestly felt like that came with the deal.
He was in everything. In fact, I think the first thing, I could be wrong because it's one of two things, but I think the first thing I ever saw him in was the episode of the Rockford Files that he was in.
Oh, no way.
And I remember this, you know, I'm a little kid, you know, and Rockford is like, you know, it's one of my favorite shows, my favorite characters of all time to this day.
You never mentioned it.
I love the show. And Saxon shows up as this guy that, you know, Rockford's got this the female character on the show named Beth, who's his lawyer, who is always kind of getting him out of scrapes and stuff. You know, they had dated on and off kind of thing. You find that out as the show goes on. And in this episode, you know, I mean, Rockford lives in a trailer and he, you know, the gun's in the cookie jar and he never gets paid and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
She sets this up to meet at the trailer with this guy that Saxon plays. And you get the sense that, oh, she's really sweet on this guy. I mean, to the point where, you know, he wants to hire Rockford. And he's in a 3-piece suit. You know, Saxon's in a 3-piece suit and he's slick as can be. And Rockford kind of turns the job down. And then Beth gives him a hard time, et cetera, et cetera. And the show, part of the narrative in the show is kind of this guy can do no wrong. Like, everything he does, everything he says, Beth just thinks, oh, my God, he loves opera. He loves this. He loves that. He's the smartest thing in the world. To the point where Rockford kind of goes, like, you know, enough is enough with this guy. And Rockford smells a rat from the first time he meets the guy. It starts with kind of a jealousy thing. But it becomes like, I don't know if I trust this guy. You know, he's just too. And I remember, because there's a scene in the episode where you get, now you've not halfway through, you get, you know who the Saxon character is, that he's, you know, he's kind of sleazy and he's, you know, sleeping with this woman who's not quite, you know, divorced and, you know, Beth and whatever. And this guy shows up at the house where he's having dinner and starts threatening him. And Saxon does his best to say, we really don't, let's not do this in the house at the dinner. And the guy keeps pushing. And Saxon goes, okay, where do you want to do this? And he goes, let's go outside. And they go outside and he takes off his sport jacket and proceeds to beat the shit out of this guy. And I remember as a kid going, that guy's freaking cool. Like, he's, because he's, you know, he's built, you know, he's built in a way that you didn't see TV guys, you know, as, you know, broad chested as he was, you know, at the time. And like, he, you know, he's in the button down long sleeve shirt and a vest. And he just, you can see how imposing he is. And he does karate moves.
Yeah.
In the Rockford episode.
And well, I don't know if you know this, but he actually thought Enter the Dragon was about him, eh?
No, I didn't know that, but I knew that he knew. Well, now in hindsight, you know, years later, I realized that he had been studying karate for a long time before Enter the Dragon. But, you know, the Rockford episode's got to be like 76 or 77. So Enter the Dragon was already massive at that point. And so they must have said, well, do some karate stuff. But that might have been the first thing I saw him in. Then he and Rockford have a fight later in the show, which is pretty cool. Yeah. I would just notice him in stuff. And I know it was either that or he was also in, I think he was in a Clint Eastwood. It might have been Joe Kidd. He might be playing like a bandito or something in Joe Kidd or something.
Oh, yeah.
And then I would have noticed him in that. And you know, a couple other like iconic sort of things that he showed up. And I always felt like it was kind of like, if you couldn't, you know, if, if you needed a heavy, but it wasn't, you didn't want to go light with Robert Wagner to be the, you know, the sleazeball, whatever, you'd get Saxon or whatever. But he was always good in everything he did.
Yeah, it was a very consistent performance.
Very consistent.
I think I have to say my first and earliest memory would have to be Day of the Robot from $6 Million Man, where he's basically Maskatron, I guess. But, you know, they didn't call him Maskatron.
Right.
They called him Mr. X.
Right.
And then there was a Gene Roddenberry. No, it wasn't Gene Roddenberry. It was the third pilot for the Gene Roddenberry, like the Genesis 2 series, was called Strange New World.
Genesis 2 got three pilots?
It did, in a roundabout way. The first one was called Genesis 2, and they had Alex Cord as the Dylan Hunt character. And of course,
Alex Cord.
Alex Cord is really not, I think, what the network wanted. I think, you know, like, again, I think, they asked to retool the pilot. For Genesis 2, and they came up with Planet Earth, and Planet Earth, I think, is a much more solid premise, and that's where Saxon comes in. Saxon took over for Alex Cord. He became Dylan Hunt, and he's got the moves. You know, he's a man, he's more of a man about, he's more of a Captain Kirk type.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also supposed to be a scientist. Mm-hmm. And but it's, you know, it works. And of course they streamline some things. They give them all uniforms, and it's more of a Starfleet thing. And I have a really soft spot for Planet Earth, and I saw that as a kid too. But then there's a third pilot where, like, they didn't pick up Planet Earth as a series, but they wanted a third pilot.
They just weren't sure.
Yeah, they're just concept. Like a bunch of Libras working there.
Just couldn't decide.
And Roddenberry wasn't attached to it, so it's like this, and it's basically again the end of the world, and they kept Saxon to play. I don't know if the character's name is Dylan Hunt in that one. I think it's like Vito or something, where it's a little more believable a name for a guy like John Saxon.
I love that his name wasn't like Carmine. Did you say it was
Carmine? Yeah.
You know, Baba Ghoul or something, like, and they get it with John Saxon.
Easy, Lindsay. Don't get racist.
I'm Italian. I can say Baba Ghoul. Oh, they went with John Saxon. Like, it couldn't be further from his New York Italian, you know.
John Saxon kind of works because it's like, you think of Saxons, you think of the Greeks, and he's a dark haired guy.
We needed more Italians in the '70s, you know. Like, you could have done
needed somebody to play all the Indians and Westerns.
Right, exactly. Native Americans, please.
Yeah, sorry.
But you know, he couldn't have gone with Carmine, you know, whatever. Like, that might have done some wonders for the Italian American community. I think maybe we got let down, but Alex Cord and John Saxon are great TV guy names. Those are just great.
Yeah. Yeah. He played Captain Anthony Vico in Strange New World. And I would say it's the weakest of the films, but I saw that as a very young kid.
Of the pilot. Pilot.
Strange New World was the name of the third.
I can't believe we got three pilots.
It did. And like one a year, I think. Like, I think Genesis 2 came out like in 73, and then Planet Earth came out in 74, and then Strange New World came out in 75.
Didn't he work with Bava too at some point in the 60s?
Yes, I think you're right. Or maybe I shouldn't have enthusiastically said yes without checking that. He did go to Europe for a while.
Yeah, I thought he did some what you call, what's the matter with me today? My head's pounding. Sorry. I'm thinking of Giallo. Didn't he do like a couple of Giallo movies in the 60s?
Mario Bava is, he's in The Girl Who Knew Too Much.
There you go. There you go. Hmm. Bava. Mario Bava.
Yeah, he's in a real classic. Like, one of the things that's interesting is he would do mainstream. He would do Oscar winning films. Like, he's in The Electric Horseman.
I was just saying.
But he was also in a lot of Corman shit.
He was in The Electric Horseman.
Yeah.
huge movie. That was a big part.
Yeah.
You know, he's got scenes with Redford in there. Yeah. You know, like
Not to mention that, like, Enter the Dragon was a worldwide phenomenon.
Enter the Dragon was like, I looked it up the night that we watched it, and I think the budget was like, $10-12 million or something.
Mm-hmm.
I think it made like, you know, $8 trillion, something yeah. like it made like
a bajillion like, million, yeah,
$320 million. Like in yeah. you know what it was like one of the
it's
biggest.
It's still earning an income larger than ours.
Yeah, somewhere. It's still playing in Shanghai. It's still...
well, what I mean is like it's you know, I was walking in a mall with my kids, and I forget if we're just buying ink and toner or whatever. So your dad crap you don't want to buy and
socks.
Yes. And what? There was a bin of movies by the cashier, and like I don't know, I think I was actually moaning to my daughter, like, you know, I'm not made of money. I was like, Enter the Dragon on Blu-ray for $8, and like immediately looked like a giant hypocrite. But I needed it. You know, there was no way I wasn't leaving the store without Enter the Dragon on Blu-ray.
This is why you'll forever be this mystery onion that keeps unfolding for me, layer after layer. How could you possibly not have Enter the Dragon on Blu-ray at this point?
Oh, this was a couple of years ago. I have no idea. I think it, you know, I think the thing that
what
was,
were you doing that you missed that email?
It was constantly on, like I have a couple of, I have cable still, and it was constantly on cable. And constantly in my on-demand. And I put it on about once or twice a year. And I think I just might have been like a little tired of it and never bought it. And I've learned the error of my ways. I own it on Blu-ray.
Now, didn't he know Bruce Lee? Weren't they kind of pals at that point? Or did they not know each other before the movie?
Oh, gosh. I used to know this, but I don't know it anymore.
I know Bruce Lee was buddies with Steve McQueen, I think. He was buddies with James
Coburn. Steve McQueen and James Coburn, I know.
James Corbin used to take him out in the desert and play his gong, take him out.
You know what? I just want to put this out on record. I love James Coburn to death.
I love Coburn.
I love the Flint movies.
Oh my God.
But Coburn's kung fu is.
Watch it. Careful. Careful. We'll get letters. Steady. Don't say it. Don't say it.
Yeah.
He's lanky. He's lanky. He can't help it.
Yeah, I'm lanky.
But he's like lithe. You ever seen him lankiest. Walk?
Yeah,
the way he walks in the Flint movies.
I mean, like, I love James Coburn. You know.
President's Analyst? The President's Analyst?
Yeah, I know, like that one too. Uh-oh. Yeah. I always wanted to create a parody television series. Like the world's first martial arts show, mm-hmm. and the world's first action star, and you play the old episodes now, and you have commentary, sort of like Dark Place, but it becomes very obvious. And this is the single joke of the premise: is that the guy knows nothing about martial arts. You know, like this was done in the '60s when nobody knew anything, and the guy can't because I was watching. I think it was a Fantasy Island recently where, you know, this guy is like a martial arts champion and it's his dream to fight Mako. You know, Mako is just playing a character in the show, but.
Oh, Mako, the actor.
Mako, the actor. Oh, I can't remember. He's like supposed to be like a warlord.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And they I don't know what Mako's problem is. Cause I've seen that guy do martial arts in movies, but both of them, when they would fight, the shot would pan away super far, and two of the worst stunt people in wigs would fight, you know, like, and like the one guy's just got like short blonde hair. Well, we're just going to put that Colin Baker wig on that guy, you know, like they're not even matching the wigs. And it made me laugh so hard because it's you know, these shows weren't counting on me having a high definition.
No,
television.
No. Most televisions at that point were like, you know, 15 by 15 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
People were sitting 90 feet away We had to get up to change the channel. They weren't looking at the stunt people, you know.
But I just, that was the concept I just had, was like, what if this was a television show like this?
I remember the first time as a kid where I like saw, it was watching an episode of Star Trek. And I noticed like when Kirk, speaking of karate, when Kirk went to, he does this thing that only Kirk can do, that run off the ground double kick, where like both feet kick the guy in the chest, and whatever that fight scene, whichever one I'm thinking of was, and I noticed, hey, he's wearing different shoes. There's no heel on the shoe. it's like a wrestling shoe, you know, kind of. They don't have the sexy little, you know, beetle boots they're wearing in all the other scenes. And I remember catching that the first time as a kid, going, hey, what's that about? And then, you know, like I saw, you know, saw through the looking glass kind of, and saw how they made the show kind of in it.
Almost, oh yeah. That's funny when you see that now, eh?
Well, back then too, it was like, you feel like, you know how you'd watch sitcoms when we were growing up, and like every now and then you'd see a boom mic in the shot.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd be like, oh, saw a microphone. You know, it was like, you thought you were, oh, I saw, there's a microphone right there. See the shadow? There's a microphone right there. You know, but we were probably the weird kids that were were doing that.
We're also sitting too close to the TV.
Yeah, most people. Yeah, our babysitter. Our TV was our baby. But I thought that maybe he was buddies with Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
But he must have got the part because I think I read about this right after we watched it that night. But I think, you know, he had been known to, you know, have great karate moves. Like he was, I think he did all his own shit in the movie. Like he was insistent, I think, in doing all his own fight scenes and stuff.
Yeah, because he's a black belt in not only judo, but Shotokan karate, which is really cool because Shotokan is close to the style I used to study. I think it's interesting. I'm just looking this up now because I haven't read this in years. He was supposed to die in the film, and they changed it. He had his agents, you know, request that he live, and sadly Jim Kelly dies. But that's really interesting.
I never understood why. I couldn't figure out why, with that enormous success for that movie. I mean, it was mega. I never understood why they didn't take his character and do another. Because they basically wanted to do, you know, Bruce Lee like a James Bond character from movie to movie. And he'd go and do this, you know, be an agent or, you know, whatever. Why they never said, well, Saxon lived. You know, I'm sorry that Bruce Lee died, but let's do, you know, a spinoff movie or the sequel with Saxon.
Enter,
you know,
the Roper?
Yeah. Enter the Saxon. Enter the Carmine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he was Mr. Big Roper Ragu in the movie. That's why I said that.
The Big Ragu. No, I know what you meant, but
yeah,
you know, that would have made.
That's a really interesting point. I don't know why they wouldn't have done that. But you know, even if you look at it too, after the movie, you know, Bruce Lee's dead, and they make Jim Kelly an action star briefly. And they gave him, I don't know if you've ever seen Black Belt Jones.
You know, I was going to say, they took him, and then the blaxploitation stuff that was happening, karate stuff.
Yeah.
And I guess it all made sense.
Black Belt Jones is the movie that I should love, and I don't, because it's, they hammed it up with comedy. So much comedy that it actually diffuses a pretty good movie. And I never understood what the point of that was. Like, I don't think it should have been played for laughs.
And I got to say, Saxon's moves in Den of the Dragon put Jim Kelly to shame. I'm just going to say it. Saxon.
Well, I think they're both great.
No, they are. But like, Saxon is like, he's got that, you know, he looks like he could rip your head off, kind of.
Well, yeah. The other thing is, Saxon is actually a trained actor. Whereas, like, you know, Kelly, that was like, probably his second thing in front of a camera.
Oh no, he was so great. He's great in it. I mean, like the actual coverage they gave to Saxon, you can tell it's like, oh yeah, this would make sense that he would, you know, it's such a good movie. It's so seen it a million times, but it's just so insane.
And I knew we were kind of like going to gravitate towards that, but you know, he's God, we should just go through some of his other stuff, though. Some of it memorable, some of it forgettable.
He did an speaking of Italian, didn't he do an Argento too? Didn't he do not Argento. Tenebrae? Did he do Tenebrae in like the early 80s? He's like Tenebrae's like it's about an author
that. Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is an Argento. I'm not familiar with that film.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a lot, you know, a couple of American actors, they get for it, and then
they get a nice week. They get a nice couple months in Italy.
Italy get to eat good.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
The one I remember him from, and I shouldn't have watched this as a child, but I did, was a movie called The Glove. It must have been like 10 or 11 when it came on TV, but it's a Ross Hagen movie, and John Saxon is like this bounty hunter who's got to track down a vicious ex-convict, and it's Rosie Grier, who puts on this like really scary riot glove, like leather and steel, and you know, I remember the cover of the video box is a big fist, and he's murdering people with it. Like, I don't know why Rosie Grier would need that. He's Rosie Grier.
Pretty big.
But it's and I can't really remember it that much anymore, but I just remember as a kid it kind of.
So this is like mid-70s, you think it was? It's
late 70s.
You know what he did, which I totally forgot he was in? Maybe I'm wrong about this. No, I think I'm right about this. He was in Black Christmas.
Yep.
Which is such a good movie.
I think that's his follow-up to Enter the Dragon. You know, I think he like did Enter the Dragon, filmed a Kung Fu, and then was in Black Christmas.
Black Christmas is such a... I hadn't seen it in a long time, and I watched it maybe a year ago or so, because I think there was a remake that somebody did, and I thought, oh, I should watch it. That's a really, really creepy movie. Like, it's really, you know, low budget kind of thing, but it's great.
But it's got Olivia Hussey in it, and Andrea Martin, and
that's a great flick. Yeah. So that was like, that had to be what, like 74,
I guess. Yeah, 74.
And that was Bob Clark of all people.
Yeah, yeah. Porky's and a Christmas Story.
Yeah, he does Black Christmas. He does Murder by Decree. The Sherlock Holmes, you know, hunts down Jack the Ripper with Christopher Plummer and Donald Sutherland, and you know, James Mason was in it as well, I think. And then he does Porky's, I think, and then A Christmas Story, or maybe it's the other way around. But what a strange.
He does Porky's and the Porky's 2.
He did Porky's 2 the next day, which adds.
I don't think he did Porky's 3, and God bless him.
Porky's 2. Porky's 2 answered a lot of questions from Porky. Let me tell you.
Shit, that is. Porky's 3 is hilarious, by the way, because they are like 37 years old and they're still like supposed to be like they got receding hairlines and stuff. we put it on the other night for like 5 minutes until, you know, the wife just said, oh, I can't anymore. Speaking of wives, my wife always calls him John Saxon. Like it's some sort of verb.
That works.
I guess because she's been living with me all these years. He's in the infamous film Mitchell, which is, of course, the famous Mystery Science Theater where Joel leaves. It's a Joe Don Baker piece of crap. You know, like that's. I find it really funny how much of his career is weird genre stuff and then incredibly popular, like to this day, classics. Like
I've seen Mitchell.
It's rotten. I'm not a big Joe Don Baker guy. I mean, I like him in Fletch.
But it was like that was Joe Don Baker. Like Walking Tall was huge. So
yeah,
getting all these. Yeah, yeah.
Such a big slob of a guy.
I don't think. Yeah, he always looks sweaty. Like he's just tired and he's sweating and.
You know who always liked, I always took digs at him and I always loved him for it was Leonard Maltin. Like when Leonard Maltin would review like a shitty like movie like Joysticks or something and it had Joe Don Baker in it, he would say something like, yeah, Joe Don Baker looks like he slept in a ditch for the entire movie, you know?
He maybe it was. He does. He always looks. But I'll tell you, he did a show. It was a British miniseries in 1985 called Edge of Darkness. That was such a sensation when it came out that they repeated it like the following week or something, which they'd never done for such a thing. And it stars Bob Peck, who is best known as the gameskeeper in the first Jurassic Park, the guy who notices that the raptors have been, you know, testing the weaknesses in the fence kind of thing. Oh, yeah. He died fairly young, this guy, who's a terrific actor. He's the lead. Joanne Whaley is one of the first things she did. And Joe Don Baker's in it. He's fantastic as this American cynic, you know, army guy. But it's from 1985. The soundtrack is by Michael Kamen and Eric Clapton. And it's a really they eventually remade it. They made it into a movie. Same director, Martin Campbell, who ended up doing GoldenEye, which he grabbed Joe Don Baker and kind of riffed on the character that was in Edge of Darkness.
Oh, that's interesting.
So he's kind of riffing on that Jedburgh character from Edge of Darkness. And then Martin Campbell, the same director, remade it as a movie with Mel Gibson and Ray Winston and Danny Houston and a bunch of other people. And I have to say, you know, regardless of Mel Gibson's, you know, this is post Mel Gibson's, you know, the bad stuff. It's a great movie. It's rare that you can take like a 2-night miniseries thing and make it into a 2-hour movie that works, but it really does work. And it's about, you know, nuclear power and, you know, radiation, you know, poisoning and things like that. And this dad that's, you know, something tragic happens. He's trying to get to the truth. But Joe Don Baker's terrific. If you can ever find the miniseries from 85, really great.
Yeah, I think he's good with the right director and the right vehicle. Yeah. Yeah. I just don't think he's the hero of a movie.
No. Not at all. You don't want to leave him back in town looking after things because he will eventually take over. Yeah. And then really the next thing I might remember having seen Saxon in that really, I mean, you know, at the time I'm saying like, I'd see him pop up in things, but then the next thing I probably saw him in that I was like, oh shit, there he is, was Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah. That is a huge claim to fame. And I think that is a fan favorite. I remember Battle Beyond the Stars, but let's talk about Elm Street.
Go back to that. I don't even know if I noticed that was him in Battle when I saw that.
Really?
I don't know if I noticed it was him. You think I was just? I think I was kind of. Look, I enjoyed the film. I paid for it. I was a kid. I saw it, but I remember kind of thinking, I can't wait to get to the mall after this and look for.
No way. Yeah, I have an appreciation for it now more than ever. I think of all the Star Wars knockoffs, it's one of the most solid in terms of its story, because it's, you know, it's also aping Kurosawa. Its dialogue is great. The actors are great. It's very straightforward.
Did John Sayles do the script for that?
Yeah, John Sayles did it. And you know, there's nothing, I quite like it. But I guess it doesn't, like, you know, like everyone goes to like Star Crash or because they're crazy, you know, they're crazy. And Battle Beyond the Stars isn't really crazy. It's a pretty straightforward. There's some tongue in cheek humor in it.
Yeah.
But it is a pretty solid Star Wars knockoff.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I actually think it's one of the best because it actually has, you know, this beginning, middle and end that work. But
who was the lizard guy? He was my favorite. God, who's that guy?
Oh,
I always forget because you had George Peppard, you had Robert Vaughn playing the exact same character he played in.
Yeah, that always makes me laugh.
Same guy, but in space.
The worst thing I've ever seen an actor do is there's this depressing Canadian movie called Going Down the Road, and in I think it came out in 69 or 70, and the SCTV decides to parody it around 1980.
Uh-huh.
And the actress who plays Betty in Going Down the Road, plays the same character in the SCTV parody.
Jeez.
And you know,
oh, wow,
that was the joke. That was right. Like the, well, you know, she's living in Toronto. We could probably get her.
We could probably get her.
They probably knew her, but it was just sort of like, oh my God, like, how does that feel to be the character in the SCTV parody, you know? And it wasn't like they said, you know, starring Jane Eastwood. No, nobody knew who Jane Eastwood was, the lady from the Hudson's Bay commercials, you know, like, we didn't know who she was.
But these guys, like, even guys like, you know, Robert Vaughn, you know, he was in Bullet. I mean, he was in Man from U.N.C.L.E. was a huge show. He was in mm-hmm. Bullet and Saxon was in all these big things. And then you get to like 1980 and it's like, everybody has to work. They got to keep working. And
just to get the Lizard Man was played by Morgan Woodward.
Oh, Morgan Woodward.
Morgan yeah. Woodward is in everything.
And should I know who that is?
Well, he's in two Star Treks.
Which
you'd know his face. He looked like he was 60 when he was 30, and I think he just got around.
What we like to call the Victor Buono syndrome.
Yeah. But he lived to be 93, unlike Victor Buono, who died at 27. And yeah, like he's
I can't believe that Victor Buono died at 27.
I'm kidding.
Oh fuck! I'm like, maybe he did because he was he could have, he might have. He was 23 in Man from Atlantis. He looked 90.
Victor Buono died at maybe he lived a little.
Oh, this, 29.
He died at 43.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure that this is not the first time we've had this discussion on.
No, here. We're mildly obsessed with Victor Buono because.
Yes. Oh, do you blame us?
Well, he's a one of a kind. Come
captivating.
On.
Kind. I say that unironically. The Nightmare on Elm Street. He is actually in two of those.
He's in. Let me get. See if I can get this. I know he's in one. I think he's in. I know he's in the one that was called New
Three.
Well, he's in one called New Nightmare where he plays himself. So that's like the fourth or fifth one.
He's in the original one, then he's in Dream Warriors.
I was going to say, I think he's in the third one too. Because What's-Her-Name is in the third one helping these kids that are having these dreams. And I think he shows up at some point to help or something. Because I don't know if he knows the truth in Nightmare 1, but in Nightmare 3, I think he understands that there's something going on here. He knows the truth or whatever.
And he even got his you know, Tarantino moment, because he has a scene in Dust Till Dawn.
He's in Dust Till Dawn, and I think he did Tarantino put him in something else, I know, because I remember reading Tarantino talking about him one time. I want to say Tarantino did something. Tarantino was, you know, those like the mid 90s. He'd show up in things and the Margaret Cho show, and
there was some show
I think he directed ER one time, maybe.
Yeah, he would do weird things. Yeah, he was kind of like enjoying himself in Hollywood.
Yeah, I think he did something that Saxon was in or something, I think. But I love that. I love that guys like him,
yeah,
you know, Saxon and Don Stroud and all these guys that
another, you know, Fantasy Island regular.
Don Stroud?
Yeah.
Do you know what happened to him, by the way? Did you ever hear what happened to him?
No.
Because, you know, he shows up in Django. He's at the beginning of Django, I think.
No kidding.
And people hadn't seen it. Now, look, I could be getting this wrong. People need to look it up and figure it out. But you had to do a double take to realize it was Don Stroud. Like, he was in License to Kill in 1989, and he showed up and stuff. Like, he was this good-looking guy. He wore a hairpiece after a while, whatever. But there's something about him when you see him in Django that's like, okay, I can't believe that's the same guy. Like, his half of his face looks very different. And either somebody said it was something to do with getting hit in the face with something or getting cut or something that destroyed some nerves or something and needed to get repaired, or I don't know what, but it's, someone will have to look it up. It's something bad happened to Don Stroud and kind of derailed his career. And then Tarantino grabbed him and put him in Django, I think. That was the next thing he did, maybe.
Oh, really? Yeah, I didn't know that. I just know they seem to be like on Fantasy Island. Hey, we need a rapey guy, and it would be Don Stroud. Like he, yeah. I'm pretty sure. There's at least two separate episodes of Fantasy Island where he is putting the moves on actress Phyllis Davis from Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, I've seen this one. No, wait, this is a different one. Like, it's just they just paired those two for some reason.
Hey, guy had the market cornered. Got to give it to him.
Yep. Phyllis Davis stalker.
Do what you're good at.
Yeah. go with what you know. Yeah, and he made, Saxon made incredible TV appearances. You know, he's on, like, almost everything. The Time Tunnel, Bonanza, Ironside, Night Gallery, Kung Fu, as I mentioned.
Oh, you know what? He was in The Virginian with Harrison Ford.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think he was, because Harrison Ford, you just made me think of it, because Harrison Ford was in an episode of Kung Fu, I remember.
Yeah, he plays Mr. Ford.
Mr. Harrison.
Mr. Harrison was the character's Harrison name. Ford. Like, it must have been really hard for him that day. And yeah.
Did he ever show up in like a sitcom in the 70s or early 80s? Did he ever veer into...
He seemed to be doing a lot of, you know, the hour-long dramas, you know.
Yeah.
He's on an episode of Fantastic Journey that's one of my favorites, where they're like aliens trapped in the vortex that are going to conquer the earth.
He's a good-looking guy. I mean, he's striking-looking. And you could see, you know, he could be the romantic, he could be the sleazeball, and he could be the heavy, you know. He just kind of, you know.
He did have a long stint on Falcon Crest. And I know this because my grandma watched Falcon Crest.
Great show.
And my favorite too.
Is that the one with Robert Forrest? Is he the lead in that one? He had a perm and a beard. With Brolin. What am I thinking of? Falcon Crest was the one with
Jane Wyman was the star of
Jane Wyman, and who was the guy? Robert
Foxworth.
Foxworthy. Foxworth? Yeah.
No, not Jeff Foxworthy.
Jeff Foxworthy.
Yeah, Jeff Foxworthy was on it. He was
the lead actor.
19.
Falcon Crest. Yes, Robert Blah Blah was the lead
Robert
guy.
Blah, blah.
He was so unmagnetic to me. I just went, I can't watch this show.
I have no idea who he is.
I was talking to my buddy the other day. What were we talking about that was like, we were going on a rant about Lucy. This is a text conversation about Lucille Ball and, you know, these shows.
As one does.
Well, only because, like, I'm one of the few people that just, I never really got Lucy. Like, I never liked the show. I never got it. I didn't like the voice or whatever. But, you know, God bless her and, you know, all the power to what she did and everything. But we were talking about the one, wasn't there one where she, like, worked at a bank and the guy, Mr. What's his name? Was
Mr. Mooney.
Mr. Mooney.
Yeah, I gotta admit, those shows do not work for me at all. They are...
It's like, we saw them all because we would sit there and we'd be waiting for, I don't know, Barney Miller or McHale's Navy or
something. Yeah, oh, absolutely.
So we sat through it. We sat through all these things. So
I was sitting there, though, because of Gail Gordon.
Gail Gordon, Mr. Mooney, right? He was
yes.
Mr. Mooney, right? Yeah, Gail Gordon. Yeah.
Mrs. Carmichael. Yeah.
And okay, so I get him mixed up.
He's in the Burbs.
Right. And he was not the guy that was in the Beverly Hillbillies. He was not that guy.
No, that's Mr. Drysdale.
That's Mr. Drysdale. And that woman that was in Beverly Hillbillies, his right hand, was she in the Lucy Bank show?
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay.
So she would still be on the Beverly Hillbillies. That's... what's her name?
Her name. She was wonderful. And then, but then the Drysdale guy, was he? No, I'm sorry. Mooney.
Yeah, there's no human being quite like her.
She was a trendsetter. You kidding me? That was,
yeah.
You know, I mean, that was what it was. We weren't, you know, there was no mistaking what that was. So God bless her. That was
Nancy Culp. Yeah.
Nancy Culp, yeah. Man. Was,
oh. I always like the way, I like her speaking voice.
Terrific. Yeah.
She's in the Parent Trap as well.
Yes.
How did we get here? You know, I just want to point out, too, that The other night I was trying to sleep, and then you started texting me about Marjo Gortner, and I started like going, like we're joking, and I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? I have to go to work in the morning. Like, we are having like the most unimportant conversation ever.
I'm sorry. I've been very lonely. It's been very lonely during COVID. So,
but I think you just kind of like opened with like Marjo Gortner. What the hell is with this?
No,
I just went like right for it, and
I said the next episode should be, you know, we should do sex. And I said we're gonna get shit for still not doing the Marjo Gortner. And then your response was, you know, I hate that guy, right? And I was like, no, you misunderstand. I don't admire his work. I don't think. I don't have the collected works of Marjo Gortner. I'm fascinated that the guy who was in the documentary Marjo about being a little kid preacher, that, you know, this documentary is up for like best picture or best documentary, whatever it was, ends up being the go-to guy for TV shows and movies and gets an acting career.
Yeah, he's got the screen presence that just makes me want to shower.
It's just so, it's so 70s. It's so 70s. And he's still alive, so maybe we can get him to be a guest. Wouldn't that be great?
Oh, yeah. Hi, I don't care for you. Let's get you on here.
Come on, change my mind. You've got 90 minutes. Go.
Change my mind. The minute he... Oh. The only movie that I like him in is Earthquake. Because he's a psycho in it. And it just seems somewhat believable.
You know what? That was on... This is going maybe 6-8 months ago. I don't know when it was. Time has stood still. I don't know when it was on. But it was on a while back on like TCM. And I bet I haven't seen it since the movie of the week, you know, as a kid or whatever. And I remember certain things about it, and Ava Gardner and Heston. And I start watching this movie, and it is so horrendously bad. Like, there's a scene at one point, Walter Matthau shows up at the bar.
Yeah.
Doesn't speak a word of dialogue. But basically the audience is like, oh, there's Walter Matthau. And he's playing a drunk, like, you know, right out of vaudeville.
Like how a little kid plays a drunk.
Like a little kid playing a hobo for Halloween.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the I don't remember any of this.
All he needs is like that Looney Tunes, you know, trombone following him around. Like, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm going, I don't remember any of this madness from this movie. And then there's like the motorcycle thing. And they're going to do
the end, never ending motorcycle stunt plot that goes nowhere. Isn't that Shaft too? Isn't that like Richard Roundtree?
It's Roundtree, and the woman is somebody too.
Principle.
It's Victoria Principle. It's like one of the first, and I'm like, that's Victoria Principle. Holy shit!
With an awful afro.
Yes. But I'm watching it, going, I don't remember any of this. I remember the highways collapsing and Heston.
Well, that's what you were all there for, and the rest of it, it's like Godzilla movies. The problem with a lot of Godzilla movies is you do not care what's happening on the ground.
No, for 90 minutes.
Yeah, and then it's like, oh, that's this. I only came here to see the monster.
Speaking of earthquakes, I just have to say, while we're on the subject, I've lived here now over 20 years in LA, and I've been through tremors, and I've been through rolling earthquakes, and I've been through little earthquakes and medium size and so on. The earthquake that hit here the other night, which was like 4 or 5 nights ago now, was like 11:30 at night. And I honestly can say, in all the stuff I've been through, I've never experienced this. Again, it's not like, you know, things were flying across the room and the ceiling came in, but the noise of this earthquake, the rumbling noise, and then stuff flying off the shelves, because it did fall off a bunch of shelves, which has never happened before. But things like rolled across the floor, you know, and it was like, and, you know, Bowie went nuts. But it was like, I ended up, you know, staying up the rest of the night, put on shoes, sat up and thought, we're going to have another one. We're going to have some aftershocks. But it was scary. I normally get kind of spooked, but I was full on scared. And then, of course, my friend, same friend who was talking about Lucy, texted the next day and was joking about the movie Earthquake.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's where we're headed. And so, yeah. So we got that to look forward to, as well as everything else that's going on right now in this country.
It's a crazy world.
Somebody else.
I wanted to point out that I actually got to meet John Saxon, and I did. Yeah, he did make the convention rounds.
You met him with Jim Kelly, right? Or was it Jim Neighbors?
No, I met Jim Kelly in 2013, just before he died. Mm. And God, he's just such a sweet guy. Oh. Meeting Saxon, unfortunately, I think I waited too long. He was very, very convivial, very nice, but I could tell that he was starting to go. And he wasn't mentally present at this show. He was very nice. He had no line, which really pissed me off. And then, so I bought two autographs. I bought one for my friend, and I got the Dylan Hunt, and I got Mr. Roper for my my friend. And when they handed him the Dylan Hunt photo, he went, "That's me."
Oh,
and I, oh no, you know. He
make it to 80 or early his early 80s kind of or something?
Didn't yeah. What happened? He died at 80, he's 83, and I think I met him when he was like 80 or 81. And what happened was immediately after we left, I read a note that said that was his last appearance.
Oh,
yeah. So he lived a long, full life and a good one, it seems. And he certainly had a huge impact on me.
You know, people, we think in terms of like the stuff that we love and the people that are in these things, you know, like I suppose growing up, we kind of thought, well, it's constantly replayed. You know, we keep seeing it repeated and stuff. They're always doing stuff, or maybe they show up in this, that, the other thing. You know, they're doing fine. You know, but it's as you get older and you start to understand how that all works. Somebody could do a series for 3 years and not get much in the way of royalties, and then not work for however long. And the key was always like to just keep working, to keep taking the work, and keep trying to be relevant, and take the stuff that came up. And Saxon is like, when you really think about all the stuff that he did and the length of time that he did it, like, I don't know what the thing is he did, but
it seems like he ran from about the 50s to the 2000s.
I mean, that's
and he just this CSI episode that was directed by Tarantino. That's probably what you're thinking of.
CSI? Tarantino directed CSI?
Yes.
Nope. Yeah.
Wow. And, yeah. The
fifth trying to season. Direct David. What's his name?
David. Oh yeah, I know who you're talking about. The ginger guy.
There was a time where he didn't want to. He demanded not to have to walk through a doorway on that show. He'd done so many seasons. He'd be like, don't put any scenes in the script where I have to walk through a doorway.
I want to be that crazy.
Right? Like, wait a minute. I do some of my best acting through doorways. Why
No one may mention apples to me. Even if I'm eating one.
Wow, he did a CSI. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just done so much that it's like a dartboard, You can hit something.
And all over the place.
Yeah.
European stuff, American stuff, movies, westerns, TV, every TV show you can think of, pilots.
Queen of Blood. A-Teams. It's crazy.
And how about that, I'd imagine that the nightmare thing, I'd imagine that served him well. Like horror conventions when they started to kick off, that he was in one of the biggest franchises of all time, horror franchises, Nightmare on Elm Street, that first one, and Black Christmas and things like that, and then Enter the Dragon. So he probably did very well going to all those shows and stuff all over the world, I'd imagine, on those laurels, made some bread.
Absolutely. He probably, I don't know how much money he made, but with a long history like this, and I hate when that messenger comes in. With a long history like this, you got to figure that he did okay in life.
Yeah, I would like to think so. That he, it's hard to know with these things, you know, like what, like he was in three Nightmare on Elm Street movies. He got,
yeah,
the, whatever his salary was. And then you think, well, I mean, I occasionally get checks from like a DVD release. I did some, you know, ADR work in some, this movie, this comedy. So I'll get a check for like, I don't know, $300, you know, like four times a year from DVD royalties or something.
Oh, now, cool.
Well, that's like, it's cool, but it's like, you go, oh, that's just me on the tiny, tiny, tiny bottom of the rung of the ladder. But like, if you're someone that, you know, got to re-up a deal or something, I don't know. Like, I don't know what leads get in those things. Sometimes it's just, you know.
I was watching Emo Phillips once somewhere showing off his royalty checks from UHF. And they're like $7.
Yeah. Yeah. My friend, guy, Steve Banos, put stuff on Facebook sometimes and it's like 75 cents.
Yeah, yeah. It was that great Seinfeld where he's getting checks for like a quarter.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I suppose you do enough stuff and you know, minimums or royalties or things, like maybe it was enough to,
yeah,
to be fine. I don't, you know, that's why, you know, I know I've joked about it a million times, but you just said nobody was in line for sax. And I always think about the Shrine and the TV Zayas, that guy was there every.
So first in line for Booth Coleman.
There every Sunday. It was like that, you know, that scene in Pee Wee's Big Adventure when he's trying to get all the animals out of the pet store when the fire happens and he keeps walking. he keeps walking past the snakes. And he's like, I'm not going to. And then he goes and he goes. Like, finally, he grabs him and runs out. Like, every time I'd be there, I thought, one of these times I'm going to have to buy an autograph from Booth Coleman because I see him, you know, every month. I feel bad for the guy. He's like, you know, he's reading, you know, some book or something sitting there. I never did. I'm ashamed of myself that I never did.
What's the saddest, celebrity, signing thing you've ever seen?
Saddest, like, line? Or, like, nobody knew was
just
there?
Just the saddest thing you've witnessed. I'll give you a mind. Like, there's been a couple. One was, I did a comic book show with my son that, I guess, like, I found out about it and went on the Friday afternoon, but it was a big affair. But it's like, did anyone else tell anyone about this? Because I it was just wide aisles for there was nobody there,
right?
And it was this big one down at the CNE, and I remember they had like 40 guests, and the reason I went was Gil Gerard was there, and I got, you know, his autograph, and I snubbed Erin Gray and felt bad because I didn't bring anything for her to sign. But there was a line of retired wrestlers. Like, I'm talking, to get to Gil Gerard, I had to walk by 15, 20 tables of guys that I didn't know who they were.
Oh, geez.
And they were all, like, there was nobody there. And they were all carnival barking me. Oh, with their wrestling lingo. Like, come here, buddy, there, get over here, buddy. And I was just like, yeah, I don't, you're all, like, just people to, like, I felt so bad for them, you know, because it's gonna be a long day.
Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, there were times, like, when Comic-Con, like, when I first kind of discovered it, and I there was things upstairs, and you'd see certain faces. I remember one time seeing, you say kind of sad, this is me, I don't mean to be mean, it's not mean, it's just, I remember seeing Mark Singer.
Yeah.
Just kind of off by himself at one point.
He's actually a treat to meet,
and nobody around. And but when somebody came around, he was so nice. I just remember what he was wearing, and I was kind of shocked at what he was wearing, sort of. But I won't go into that because that's just mean. But it just seemed like, you know, he's seen better days, kind of thing. It was more that.
He's actually one of my favorite celebrity encounters because my wife was a huge fan of V growing up and had a crush on him.
Oh.
And my God, like, I've met some celebrities over the years that haven't been so fun to meet, and he was definitely in the fun to meet pile. He was a real gentleman.
He was full of energy, and he was totally, you know, with some people and stuff. But yeah, the Shrine, some of the Shrine stuff was just, it was always Booth Coleman and Herb Jefferson Jr.
Oh, Boomer.
yeah, were there every month. And Herb Jefferson was always brought a paperback to read. And when people would sort of need, you know, want to talk or get it, it was kind of like you get the autograph and that's it. I'm going back to my book kind of thing. And he just kind of had to get through it. But I will tell you one of the worst, I think, was toward the end for Stan Lee. I sort of saw him. They walked him through a crowd at Comic-Con. And this was, you know, maybe 4 years before he died or something, or three years before he died or something.
Yeah.
It just already seemed like, you know, he doesn't know where he is right now. Like, And then when you heard afterwards just how much they were trotting him out and how little he knew what the hell was going on, you know, getting him to sign stuff and what the management did and other kinds of weirdness and stuff. So I remember kind of seeing that and thinking that he shouldn't be here right now. Like this, that's. And I got to meet the day that I met Lou Scheimer.
Oh, I love Scheimer.
And I got to tell him what that show meant to me, what Flash Gordon meant to me.
Yeah. I did the same with Tarzan.
And I went and I said, I'm going to get you something. I want to just, it's not the animated show, but it's, you know, because of that became the movie, became the thing. And now here I am doing this stuff. And I said, he goes, and he was so unbelievably nice, just overjoyed, so flattered by the whole thing.
Yeah,
and he seemed good. He was okay, kind of thing. And I remember after that, we kind of lingered because somebody I was with that was talking to him or talking to somebody else, and he kind of turned to either his wife or whoever it was and said,
"His daughter usually."
Daughter is kind of. He must have like whispered, like, "I, you know, I'm ready to go back now. Ready to go back to the hotel," kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then she kind of, you could see them kind of getting their stuff together to go. And so I said, "Well, I'll come back tomorrow." And then I went to get the stuff to bring it back the next day. And when I went to the table, they weren't there. And the guy said, "Oh yeah, Louis, he was pretty, you know, pretty tired after yesterday. It kind of, you know, he's had some health issues, whatever." And then I think he died like maybe 6-8 months after that or something.
Yeah. Didn't make
the next Comic-Con. But I could tell that he was, you know, he was a gentleman. He was in like, I think he was in a white jacket maybe and trousers, and he was super nice, but he could tell he was, I forget what he had at that point. Or what,
I think
what
he did have Alzheimer's. And yeah. I think that's what Saxon had too. The one thing I should say is he had been to Toronto several times before. So there was not much of a line for him because, you know, it wasn't his first trip to Canada. And I think that may have had a huge effect on it because he had come at least in 2014 for sure. And this was like, you know, 2-3 years later. So it probably had an effect on the attendance at his table a bit.
I urge you as a fan to look up the Rockford Files episode, which is also one of the best episodes. It's a great, very funny. I'll have to do that.
I wonder if I have that streaming anywhere.
It's quintessential Rockford getting kind of screwed, you know, by this double dealing thing.
Slick-talking guy.
Yeah.
What is the one I wanted to? Oh yeah. Get off there. I had the funniest kind of saddest moment I've ever seen of a celebrity was I went to a Comic-Con in Detroit, and I got there like super early, like nobody was there in the morning, and I walked all the way through the celebrities, and usually most of the celebrities weren't there. And there was Robert Zadar. Do you know who he is?
Oh, I'll tell you. You tell me this, and I'll tell you my Robert Zadar story.
Okay. He's on the phone with somebody, and he looks sad. He looks like he might be a little hungover. And he was like, "I'm sorry, I know, I'll try to." And I was staring at him, and then he kind of looked at me, and I was like, oh God, I'm eavesdropping on Robert Zadar. And I just felt bad. Because he clearly didn't want to be there.
So what year do you think that was?
That was probably 2011, 2011.
Okay, because I used to go to a bar on Sunset, which is no longer there. The building is there, but I don't even remember what it was called now. Not Dublin's, but it was across the street from Dublin's, but I forget the name of it. But it was this cool little bar that had a downstairs. It was very much like a pub down there, like, you know, with wooden tables, and you could have, you know, parties down there and stuff. But I would go to this bar, and he worked the door, He was at the door. He was the bouncer checking IDs. And I knew who he was. I didn't know his name off the top of my head, like the first time I saw him. But I, you know, I said, you know, hi to him one night and show him my ID. And then I was, you know, I smoked at the time. So I'd go outside for a cigarette because they had just changed the law where you had to go outside kind of thing. So this is like 98 or something, maybe.
Yeah.
98. And we would just hang out and talk. I would just ask him how he's been and what's he been up to. And like, just trying, you know, I'd said like, hey, I really admire your work kind of thing. He's like, oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that. But it was kind of like this self-conscious thing of, you know, here I am working the door sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then we would just sort of talk. We would just sort of bullshit. And then, you know, I saw him maybe two times after that when I'd go there, and he was always, he just let me right in with, you know, I mean, it wasn't like it was a cover, but it was just like, oh yeah, come on, like whoever I was with kind of thing. And he was cool. But, you know, that was a sobering kind of thing. Not that he was ever, you know, Eric Estrada, but like, you know, that's, I mean, you know, when I first moved here, I had my car parked up at Universal City Walk by one of the dudes in Clerks.
Yeah. Just
parked cars up at City Walk and didn't want to be recognized, you know, and people, you know. So again, back to this whole, like, people need to work. They got to keep working. They got to keep taking stuff. And, you know, it's the people that get to a level where you go, why did you need to do that? Like, you, surely you're well past having to do something like that. What are you doing?
Yeah.
That's stuff that I get more fascinated by.
Yeah, and it's usually some deal connected to it, you know, some passion project. And, you know, if you do this, you'll get to do this kind of thing.
Yeah, or like there was one on the other day. There's a new Netflix movie. I forget what it's called. The Devil's Taking a Day Off, or The Devil's on Lunch Break, or whatever. Something about the devil in the South. I know nothing about the South. But, you know, I know that it's not inhabited by British and Australian and Swedish actors that are playing, you know, rednecks. That's the entire cast. So it's Tom Holland, Tom, what's his name, who plays Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah, that came into my radar
and a perfectly fine thing to watch. But when you get to the end of it, you go, my God, the people that are in this thing.
Yeah.
Surely they must be far busier than to look at this script and go, I got to make this. We got to make this thing. I'm in. Count me in. You know, what's his name is in it?
Sebastian Stan. Yeah.
Sebastian Stan is in it. And somebody else is in it. Spider-Man. There's like three British people.
Yeah.
Two Australian people, a Swedish guy, and then one American. All playing rednecks in this thing. But it's just the kind of thing where you finish it and you're like, That's a lot of talent and a lot of organizing to get all those people. And this is what you want to spend your time on? This? At this level? So shit like that, I always go like, I don't...
To wrap up this conversation, do you think we're past the age of the Saxon or the Roddy McDowell, where they would do episodic TV, movies, it didn't matter? You know, they just wanted to keep going. Or, you know, are we now just in a world where, you know, you're a movie star, you're a TV star, and that's it?
I think if anything, it has, because there used to be that stigma many, many, many years. I remember my father would always say that, like, my father knew everything. So, you know, if he saw some guy that, like, George C. Scott took a TV show, he'd go, he used to say he'd never do television because he was only a movie, you know.
Yeah.
I think years ago was...
I know the name of that show.
It was kind of either or like, you know, Roddy McDowell could do both.
Yeah.
You know, it was fine. But if you were like the leading guy or whatever, and then it dipped in, you know, Garner's a great example of a guy who was big in television with Maverick, goes into movies, he's huge in movies, goes back to television, goes back to movies. Like, it's very rare that people could do that throughout their careers. But I think if anything now, there's a hip factor to showing up in things. Like, I've been getting it. You know this cartoon called, what's it called? Something Falls. Not Wonder Falls, but...
Gravity Falls?
Gravity Falls. Have you seen this show?
Oh, yeah. I have kids.
Oh, it's so good. It's so smart. And I've just kind of, you know, I saw the first season and now I'm discovering that... And all these voices show up and you go, oh, my God, that's Stephen Root. Oh, that's Linda Cardellini. That's whatever. So I think now it's like... I think you see more of it now with all there's so many more platforms now. Whereas before it was, more jobbing maybe, but now it's kind of, I think it's become more hip now to show up in things.
Yeah, okay. I'll give you that.
Wrong,
yeah.
I could be wrong, but I don't know if there's quite the, you know, quite the stigma now. But like, you know, think of like the hip, you know, think of John Hamm showing up on, you know, 30 Rock or whatever, you know, stuff like that.
Or John Hamm showing up on absolutely everything.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, could be. I mean, yeah. But it was, there was something comforting to it too, where you'd see it, you know, you'd see Saxon or something, you wouldn't go, oh, he had to do another episode of whatever. It's like, you saw them on Fantasy Island. You're like, they're working. These people are, you know, they don't just let anybody on this show.
You can't just walk in and ask to work with Donnie Most.
You can't just get Bob Denver for anything.
Yeah, well, actually, I think at that point
you did. I tell you this?
That may have been a bad example.
Speaking of Bob Denver, and only you would appreciate this. Yep. I think I've told you before about this guy I've known for years. Steve Kozak is executive producing a documentary on the Star Wars Holiday Special.
Oh yeah, wonderful.
Talking to me about it for years, and I've been kind of, now that it's sort of kicked off, and I've been interviewed for it, and he's getting everybody involved with this thing. I mean, when I start to, you know, off air, I'll tell you more about the history of this. It will fascinate you because it's everything about 70s TV that's just insane that we kind of love.
I can't wait to dig into that.
The woman who played, I'm just going to leave you with this.
Okay.
The woman who played Lumpy, Chewbacca's son in Star Wars Holiday Special, was also the woman who was inside the Dorse on this far out space.
Space Nuts, yeah.
And at the time, she was dating Bob Denver. They started a romance while they were making the Far Out Space Nuts. And they were still together while she was doing the Star Wars Holiday Special.
That's incredible.
So there you go.
I mean, what do you do? You're stuck in a room with Chuck McCann and Bob Denver. That is... that is a sexy duo.
You know, you got to make a choice. Chuck lost out, clearly.
I can honestly remember watching the Far Out Space Nuts, and I don't remember how old I was, probably pretty young, where I was like, Skipper looks weird. Like, why is he talking funny?
I remember seeing it and thinking, was Gilligan's Island that long ago?
His hair was gray, right?
He looked 70.
Yeah, I know. The same thing. It very clearly must have been running a rinse through his hair. I thought the exact same thing. And it's even worse when they try to young him up, like on Fantasy Island. I keep going back to that. They'll like dye his hair, and you're like, yeah, he looks like a 55-year-old guy with, you know, a dye job. Like, it didn't quite work.
That's what's so funny about some of the Fantasy Island stuff and the faces that would show up. It's like, well, they, you know, chances are you saw them that afternoon. Like, Gilligan was running.
Yeah.
Was like, that was a get. It was like, well, that's going to get people to watch because they're, you know, they're familiar with him. He's in the consciousness already. So
it's I find it fascinating. Like, my kids don't have that.
Yeah,
they didn't have to. They could watch cartoons all the time, so like there is no pop culture reference of Gilligan's Island to my children because they're like, that was a terrible cartoon you showed us once, and it's like, oh, that's what Gilligan's Island is to them, or you know, like they didn't get exposed to it, and they have a completely different pop culture reference point. So
yeah,
Gilligan's Island may die with us.
Yeah, well, there is that. A lot of this stuff is sort of, you know, when you mentioned Roddy McDowell, and I actually watched, I don't know why, but I have a long freaking queue with Amazon Prime. But the other night I watched Lord Love a Duck on Amazon Prime. I had never seen it, and it's completely mental. And Roddy's the lead. You know, he's this kind of strange asexual Svengali in this strange movie that's kind of skewing beach blanket movies and the teen culture and stuff like that, and it's very strange.
I have to go check that out.
he's just, you know, it's just freaking, he's so comforting. He's Roddy McDowall. He's always Roddy McDowall in everything he does. And I love him to bits. And, you know, but I wonder, like, what is Roddy McDowall going to mean to people before long? Like, you know, is he, you know, that is definitely a generational thing. Shatner is like, that's a different story. You know, Bob Denver, no. But Shatner's one of the, he's iconic. Like, the generation after generation will know that show. Generations will know Planet of the Apes. Will they know Roddy McDowall by face? That's a good question.
Also the voice of Vincent.
Not credited.
Not credited, but he does another Disney film, didn't he?
He did The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes. He was a computer.
No, he was not.
No, I'm kidding. He wasn't. That's not true.
I'm pretty sure he did Pixar films.
He did. The last thing he did, I believe, was one of the ants in one of the bugs, in, the ants in Bugs Life.
Bugs Life. Yeah. Okay. I was right. Yeah.
And he was the Mad Hatter on the Batman animated series, too.
I think McDowell and Saxon will live for a long time because they both have some works that are not forgotten.
I think so.
And
as long as there's geeks like us to keep telling people about him,
that's right.
I'm sure they will live on. That's our mission. All right. Well, that was fun. Right.
Thanks, everybody. We're going to do a longer one next time. Well, this one was supposed to be short and it ended up very long. So,
all right.
Look at us. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Guys, stay safe. Talk soon.